Greetings all, this is Hear Her Sports, episode 5. This week I'm talking with Robin Farina, who is one of the founders of the Women's Cycling Association, an advocacy group. She and I talk about pay equality in cycling, a tour of California Twitter storm, the UCI, Virginia Slims, and one of her new projects, riding on a tandem with a blind rider on both the track and the road. I'm so excited to talk to you, I can't tell you.
I'm excited to talk to you too. My name is Robin Farina, and I guess I would call myself an athlete first and foremost. I have a love of sports, and not just one sport, but all sports. And that started from a very young age. And I played soccer growing up, all through high school, got into volleyball, tennis, basketball. I played everything. And I would say it's who I identified as growing up. But come to find out later in life, it taught me just about everything that I have learned in life through sports.
One of the questions that I have been asking people is, do they call themselves an athlete? And so many women that I've spoken to have said no. And it's been really interesting to me. And now here you are, you say that you've called yourself an athlete for a very long time. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, I just feel like that's, at the end of the day, like that's who I am. I guess, you know, people call themselves lovers and fighters and warriors. And I think, like, I try to be both a lover and a warrior, but I feel like at the end of the day, like, competition drives me. And that's one of the reasons I got into cycling, was because I went to college and played volleyball and tennis at a very small school, and then transferred to the University of Tennessee because I wanted a degree in sports management. I wanted to own a team. I wanted to be a general manager of a big sports team. I wanted to be on ESPN. Like, that was what I saw myself doing back in the late 90s when I went to Tennessee. And I did get a degree in sport management. And then I went and took a job at the Atlanta Braves for a year, and then got an offer to come back to Nashville and work for the Nashville Sports Council there, which was solely responsible for bringing economic development to Nashville through sporting events. Whether that was the Titans, the Predators, NCAA basketball tournaments, the Music City Marathon. So I got to be, at a very early age, on the ground floor of a organization that was about bringing sports to Nashville, whether that was through marketing, event management, promotions, sponsorship. So I knew from a very young age that that's where I belonged and that's what I wanted to do. And then about 4 years later, I was introduced to cycling. And I never thought of myself as a cyclist, never even dreamed about riding a bike. That was just something. I grew up in the Southeast in Nashville, and people didn't ride bikes. You know, we drove cars. We would take minivans to get to our sporting events. So I went to Tennessee and never really, I saw people riding bikes to class, but I never knew there was a competitive level of cycling. And so I went to my local bike shop, and, you know, they started talking me through the process of buying bikes, and they sold me an upright bike, very slow upright bike. And surely enough, that was not good enough for me. I got passed by people. It was not what I wanted to be on. I wanted to be on something faster. So I got into mountain bike racing. I got into road racing, and, you know, soon enough, I decided I was going to give it everything I had. I was going to quit my job and pursue racing, and I was going to give myself a certain amount of time to make it as a professional. I didn't even know what that meant, but I knew I wanted to be it. So,
did you have mentors at that point?
I did. I found, yeah. I mean, like, I found people who understood the sport. I found people who would, help me grow in the sport. And they were, you know, typically they were like the local guys. I found a local coach. So I was inspired by this, I guess, level of fitness, being around guys that I had to keep up with them, or I had to, like, you know, start riding with them all the time, rather than have maybe a more calm and, you know, I guess, less aggressive entry into the sport. I was just thrown into it. I guess it was the early, I guess, late 90s, early 2000s. I still didn't feel, especially in the South, there weren't that many women racing. So, you know, we were just kind of there trial by fire. It's either you keep up or you get lost, or there is a more gentle and, I guess, more, what's the word I'm looking for? Just a slower, more developmental phase into cycling. And at that time, there really wasn't that. And so I just kind of, you know, put my head down and worked really hard and, you know, begged to be on a few pro teams and finally got my, got the nod in 2008 and found myself on my first real pro team. 11 years ago, while I was racing, I started my own coaching company because I did recognize that there, just being a pro cyclist in the women's peloton wasn't enough. And meaning it wasn't enough to survive. I couldn't pay my bills. I was at the mercy of people around me, my parents, my significant others, and I did not want to be that person. That was not going to work. So I decided to start a coaching company, and I've had that coaching company for the last 12 years now, and it has been the foundation from which I've been able to continue to race, direct, be involved in the Paralympic cycling team that I'm on now. So I feel like I'm very grateful that I saw that there was something else. That also makes me feel sad because you can't just be focused on your sport and just put your head down and work hard and do the right thing and make it in this sport. And I still feel like we're at that place today in women's cycling.
I think it's true in a lot of the sports. I mean, the U.S. soccer team is fighting the same thing.
Absolutely. I think, you know, there are very few women's sports that are actually on a level where you can just be a professional. I mean, I'd say soccer. I think soccer is probably women's soccer is there, but they're certainly not being treated equal as they should for the amount of money they're bringing in.
What are your thoughts about the relationship between increasing income for women athletes and media coverage?
Well, I don't like the whole chicken and the egg conversation. I just, like, to me, that just doesn't make, it makes sense, but it's also like, I don't want to hear about it. So the media, so I feel like in the past couple years, there's been more media around women's sports than ever before, clearly, because there's more outlets. We have so many opportunities to be on TV. I think, or live stream. Like, I was watching Real Sports the other day because I love that show. And they were talking about if professional sports, professional football and basketball were declining. And the reporters were saying that they absolutely think that the overall viewership of professional sports is decreasing because there are so many options out there. People are inundated with how many sports they can watch. And so that, to me, was a little bit troublesome because I feel like they're clearly just talking about men's sports. But then I started thinking about it. It's like, well, I don't think it's just men's sports. I think the same thing is happening to women's sports. I think there's so many out there to watch, to be involved in, to be a fan of, that we're having a hard time gaining viewership. And I do believe that it's unfortunate because, like, the women's tour down under that just happened in Australia, you could watch the whole men's tour completely from beginning to end. You could see everything that happened. You could see all the races, but you could not find the women's tour. I had a client she's a young up and coming racer. She was texting me back and forth and she said, I can't find the women's tour. And I was like, well, let me know if you do. And she's like, I'm searching all over for links. I can't find it. And to me, that was super discouraging.
See, this is one of my biggest complaints is you have to be like the major detective to find good women's sports coverage.
It's absolutely true. I mean, she's a smart girl. She works in social media. She's in sports marketing and she could not even find this link. So I was like, ultimately, I don't think there was a link. You know, it's like you have to follow on Twitter. So I truly believe, you know, I listen to the UCI, you know, and they say they're making more women's cycling more available for viewership. So that means online streaming. There was no online streaming. There was no, you know, there was no TV production. And I hate to say it, but ultimately I understand why. It's hard. This is not a TV product. Cycling is a very difficult TV product.
But they're doing it for the men. They're already doing it.
They are doing it for the men. I agree. But I think like changing the model of cycling, of how it's viewed on TV, would probably be the best answer. Meaning, like, you can't show stages that are 100K or 120K from start to finish. It's got to be a more exciting, more TV-ready product, which means a short course, more exciting, more compact, so you can see the whole thing consistently, constant.
What about track or, you know, like cyclocross?
Absolutely. Mountain biking, pro mountain biking has done it. They have cut down their length of the course. They've put it on a more exciting, more like a short course that can be live streamed the entire time. And sure enough, they're getting more people behind it. They have fans now. They have people like tuning in to watch these World Cups. And it's funny because the WCA, we actually worked on this. In 2014, we recruited Donna Lupiano, who I'm sure if you're in any kind of women's sports, you know who she is. She was the first women's AD at Texas. She's been involved in the WTA. She's done many things in the women's sports, and she still fights for women's sports today. She sat down with us and spent a lot of time creating a product that was TV ready. And this is what we came up with. Now, because cycling is so historically, I guess it just has history the way it is. It's just the people who are in it believe it still should be this certain way. I don't think it's going to change. And I think that becomes the problem as to why we can't get more coverage, is because it's not a super exciting, I should say it's not super exciting. It's totally exciting. But from a viewership standpoint, when you're just watching people ride through the countryside, and
for
I know
five
the Tour
hours.
De France, for 5 hours, I mean, even people who watch the Tour de France fall asleep during the middle of watching the tour. I do, even though I love it. And I'm so into it in the last, you know, 15K. I just feel like there's not enough money right now to see the whole thing. And so I don't think there ever will be.
Do you think that because there isn't currently coverage of women's road racing, that women's road racing can step away from the history and
Absolutely.
Create this new product that you're talking about?
Absolutely. I do. And I think what it takes is getting people behind it. You have to have the racers agree that the racers don't even matter. They're going to do whatever they're told ultimately. So it's really having the UCI buy into it, you know, and ultimately that's the ASO buying into it, because really they control everything.
Is this one of the things that the WCA is doing?
We have been working on this for a while. But I think the UCI right now, as it stands, is kind of, they're not really willing to take big steps forward right now. I think they're giving us little steps, little pieces of the pie to make us feel like they're doing the right thing. It started to get really stirred up at the UCI with women and women cycling back in probably, I think it was 2013. You know, more people started going to the UCI saying, you've got to help us step up. You know, the situation, the current state of women cycling is kind of pathetic. You know, there's no bar set what makes a pro team. There's no budget level. And to be quite honest, they've been working on that for a couple of years, and there's still no movement in that either. Like, you have to set a minimum budget to be a pro team, or else everybody is just like, you know, it's constantly undercutting people, which is why minimum salaries don't work, is because there's no minimum budgets. So if you don't have a minimum budget, you can't have a minimum salary.
Right.
And riders should really be paid minimum salaries. I mean, let's not kid around here. I helped negotiate two contracts for two of my riders that I coach, who are now on UCI pro teams, and they're making no dollars, nothing, not even getting to take a bike home at the end of the year.
Wow.
So they're basically volunteering and donating their time to make it so that hopefully next year they can be on a pro, they can get a contract for actual money.
You know, we talked a lot about the WCA, and why don't you give a little bit of history and intro to what that actually is?
The Women's Cycling Association was started in the middle of 2013 during the season. It was about 13 of us that kind of came together and decided that if we wanted to see change in women's cycling, then we had to do it ourselves. So these were pro racers that took, I remember we met, actually the Tour of California had just taken place, the Women's Tour of California. And at that time, you know, the Tour of California was, I think, two stages for the women. The men had a full seven, which they've had for several years. They were just introducing the women's Tour California. They had like one stage, then the next year one stage. I think that year we had two. And it was a criterium, which, you know, everybody could race. And then there was an invite-only time trial. And at the end of the women's time trial, there was a very big battle going on between Allison Powers and Evie Stevens, and they cut the feed for the women's time trial and went straight to the men's. The men were just starting. So the lowest rider on GC was being shown doing their time trial starting instead of what was happening at the, you know, the peak of the women's race. And I remember getting done with the race that day, and there was a Twitter storm, you know. People were just going off, and it was ridiculous, and how could they do that? And there was no explanation for why that had happened. The programming had decided to switch. The people, you know, who had the say in the race decided they were just going to go to the men's because it was more important to show them. And I don't think that's what they said, but that was absolutely the message that our fans and the racers took home. And so that was really the impetus to start the Women's Cycling Association, was that, gosh, this is our circle of death. It's just this constant, like, we're not equal. We're not even being considered important because our race is not important. So 13 of us met after the Philly Cycling Classic. We went into the hotel, the team hotel, the race hotel. We sat down after the race, and we just started talking about the things that we felt were the most important and that we wanted to tackle. What can we, from the gun, start making change, start seeing and start lobbying to the UCI, create an association of racers? It blossomed. You know, we made a lot of movement. We shook it up. We decided that, you know, we had to have more representation at the national and at the UCI level. And that has happened. We created a buzz through the media is what we did. And it worked. As the years have gone by, we've decided to turn focus onto planning and more grassroots, because we need the numbers, and you get the numbers from the people who support you. You know, women's cycling is small. The number of actual professional racers is not a big number at all. So, you know, just relying on the racers to do the work is really, it doesn't work that way, because they're always focused on racing. And so we had to pull in racers like Inga Thompson, who had raced back, you know, 20 years ago, maybe more than that now. We had to call in people like Donna Lupiano to help us with structure, with bylaws. And that was some of the most informative knowledge that we could have had. It was pretty amazing. So we're still in the process of moving forward. We try to reach out. We try to put on events now to create awareness, to get people more involved. We've got Iris Slappendale, who's one of our board members in Europe right now. She's actually lobbying to the UCI as we speak. So things are still happening. It's the tough part is not seeing change fast enough. And that's what's disappointing. But at the same time, I think we have to keep in perspective, like, what we're doing now is really for our future. And it's not about the racers who are racing right this moment. It's all what we can do for the future of our sport.
Right. And what are the goals for 2017?
Right now, we're still working with Iris on creating some more items to be worked on by the UCI. I think what's the unfortunate part is, like, you really can't do anything without the UCI buy-in. Like, you can try, but because of the nature of the history of this, it's always been done this way. There are certain people in the sport who will not go away. We are kind of at their mercy. And that is unfortunate. Until we can find a sponsor like a Virginia Slims, who, you know, rose women's tennis from being just another sport to the, you know, premier women's sport, then, you know, we are at the mercy of UCI. So ultimately, that is what we would like, is to find that big sponsor that can help us create a better platform for women's cycling through making it TV ready, like what we had talked about earlier.
And what kind of dollars is that?
I would say, you know, $50 million at the most to get a whole season, and then, you know, sponsoring every race throughout the season, you know, where you actually have prize money you can pay out. I mean, ultimately, that's like one player's salary in the NBA.
Right.
It's not that much. And you could support a whole sport and hundreds, maybe even 1,000 people off of that.
Right.
It's really sad.
Right.
So I guess in perspective, it's not that much. Sounds like a lot. There are some really good things happening, like the Tour of America's Dairyland. You know, they've created a new, I guess, board of directors. They've included a couple women on that board to get our feedback. I am now on that board. Dee Dee Barry Dement. She's on that. There's a couple other women that are now on that board and very vocal about how do you get more women racing? How do you get more pros to show up at races? That's been a big question. I get that all the time. Like, how do we get more women at our race? How do we want to support the pro women. We want to see them thrive. We want to give them more prize money, but how do we get them here? And the one thing I said to them is calendar coordination is everything. So if the calendar doesn't coordinate in a fashion where you can make the races, then they can't show up. They won't show up. It's too costly. So a lot of that does go back to USA Cycling because they've actually changed their calendar for 17. In fact, they've changed a lot of races. So Redlands was traditionally like the first race of the year. Now it's in May. So they're trying to have more calendar flow, geographical flow in the calendar because women's teams typically don't have the resources to have two sets of infrastructure in different areas of the country. Meaning it's really hard for them to have a race team in California operating with a director, with a mechanic, and then have that same setup in the Southeast or on the East Coast doing the same exact thing. Nor do they have enough racers to do that. So that was a harsh reality that USA Cycling had to address, and they have addressed it, and we will see the outcome of that. So just having not, you know, to drain the resources of the budget by going back and forth across the country will help.
And how is the international schedule affecting that as well? Because it seems like more and more U.S. riders are now on international teams.
Well, I think the push for that has become the realization that if you want to do well, if you want to win an Olympic gold medal, because really the Olympics is the height of women's cycling. If you win a medal, you've done as best as you can do. There is no Tour de France for the women. There is no, you know, I guess actually I would say what Megan Garnier has achieved, you know, being the leader of the Women's World Cup, that right now in a Olympic gold medal is about what you can reach, the height you can reach. The reason why you see more women jumping over and saying, I want to be on a Euro team or I want to be on a UCI team that races in Europe is because that's where you get more opportunity to race at the highest level and compete in the races that do have some coverage that have higher profile. I think we do have high profile races in the US, but you know, the Europeans come over here and cherry pick those. Whereas on a regular basis, the number of World Cups are in Europe. And so World Cups create the opportunity to get points to go to World Championships, points to the championships, World Championships then give you points to try to make the Olympic team. So it's a process. And it seems like the U.S. now has the women's teams in the U.S. have now understood the process. And they're like, if we want to be considered a major player, if we want to send women to the Olympics, we've got to be UCI status. And that UCI status, we actually have to go race in Europe.
Are you getting buy-in by the riders, by the racers themselves? I know that we talked about the Virginia Slims circuit, and that definitely had some resistance in the beginning.
Absolutely. And I think just like that, we're getting resistance as well, because it's totally different. It's something completely new. You know, telling the racers that, well, you know, those long, you know, 100-mile races, 80, 90 with lots of climbing, you know, epic climbs, those don't exist. That's not very popular because most of us got into cycling and our love for it became on those long rides, those long training rides, going up mountains and, you know, having epic days. That's just pretty much not going to work when it comes to TV-ready product for women's cycling. You know, it's going to have to be something like the Richmond course where and even the Richmond course would have to be cut, where it's condensed, you know, it's spectator friendly. You can almost watch the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, that's a tough pill to swallow. But it really depends on if you want to up the ante in women's cycling. Are you willing to sacrifice in order to get up here, to make more money, to have it on TV?
Right.
So I think it's going to be a mentality switch. It's not going to be something that's approved overnight. It may not be for another 5 years.
Well, it's also certainly a different type of race, and like an entirely different type of racing, a different type of training.
Yeah, it's like a criterium on steroids.
Right.
You know, it's a lot more demanding physically. You know, a different type of rider may succeed.
Right.
I think, but with any kind of training, though, you know, I think we all know you train for what you want to race. And
sure.
So if you wanted to be good at this, you would train for this. I think riders are typically, we're really hesitant because we feel very, I guess, okay with being safe in our spot. Like, we know what we're going to do every year, right? It's like a cycle. You know what your off season looks like. You know what your December looks like in January and so on. So it's very repetitious, right? And so when you throw something completely different, it's like nobody knows what this is going to be. They don't know how people are going to react to it. They don't know how people are going to race it.
I wonder, too, if it's going to change the team dynamics of racing. I mean, just hearing about your idea, I sort of get the sense that teams could be really exciting. You know, if you're really playing with the team members you have, it would be fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could have more teams. I don't think people would need to have 10 riders. You know, you'd probably limit it to 6 on a smaller course, you know, or maybe 7, more team tactics. I think it's just, it's like, I feel like it would encourage more aggressive racing. It would encourage, I think we get motivated by people. We get motivated by fans. If we know the world is watching, you know, when you go to a world championship, like in Richmond, people were all over the course and people raced their bikes. That was like amazing to watch. I watched it, you know, live. And I think it just motivates the riders to want to rise up and be the star or their team win. And I think that only creates just a better atmosphere for our racing. I think it would just take some time, honestly, and money. Let's not talk about like the money. If we could provide a healthy prize purse where it's like, there's good money on the line. Maybe you even give start money just to show up. But yeah, it's like those opportunities have been few and far between. So riders don't really understand that. It's not like they've been offered that.
I also think that there's a lack of sense of stability. So, you know, you never know if you're going to be on another team next year. You don't know if you're going to get one of the very few paying spots.
Yeah.
And if it was all set up, I think maybe there would be a ability to relax and, you know, actually race.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head right there. It's like, women's cycling is so competitive with each other, there's no loyalty. So how can you feel confident about racing for your teammate when you don't even know if you're going to get the job next year? You have to get your own results. That has been a problem for as long as I can remember. You know, there are a couple riders, those GC riders, who are super valuable, and everybody else is expendable. And oftentimes there's no like going to bat for another teammate because you're trying to get that contract for as much as you can, not worrying about what anybody else gets. So there is no security in our sport at all. You could be at the top of your game 1 year and then find yourself without a contract the next year. That happens. Everybody's told to mind their manners and behave. If you become a rider or an athlete that, it works for some people. It works for some sports. It doesn't work for cycling. You know, you're labeled as a troublemaker. You're labeled as, you know, someone, a wild card, someone like team can't trust. They're very, you know, I think cycling is very into conformity. You know, we all want you to look the same. We all want you to, you know, portray a positive image. But not having any personality, not saying what you feel, I mean, that was ultimately one of the reasons I decided to retire when I did, is that I was tired of no positive change. I can't say no positive change, not enough change quick enough. And I was like, you know what? I can do more positive good. I can be more positive influencer by being out of the sport and being able to talk about it and make and take action rather than trying to like fall within these rules.
Well, that's a good segue to what can riders, you know, around the country do to promote women's cycling and to get more women involved?
Well, that's a great question. And I think, you know, ultimately to get more women involved in cycling, it's definitely like going out there and riding more with maybe people you wouldn't ride with, or going to bike shops, doing events, putting yourself out there in the community. One of the things the WCA did, we started doing the Join the Ride Tour, which was creating a ride in different regions of the country. But we would encourage women to come out and enjoy a day of being around pros, being around other women, enjoying camaraderie and the social aspect. It wasn't necessarily a race. And then when you get women there, then you talk about like women's racing and how to become a fan, and you know where you can watch us if you can, or how, you know, the races, the teams that you can be a fan of. And so it really takes a movement from the grassroots side to really become a reality. When you look at like the big stars, like the Ronda Rouseys, well, though she's not a big star right now, but you know, she was like my hero for a while, and she still is my hero, even though I'm really sad about her last fight. But like, she was out there, she put herself out there. She was, you know, she was on every TV show and just like, you know, talking about what a great sport that she was involved in. And I think we need more of that. We need more women that are willing to, you know, be on TV and be interviewed. And you just have to take those opportunities. It may not be part of your regular standard program. It may not be, you know, what you do on a daily basis, but we've got to show the world the personalities that we have. We need to do a better job of reaching out and kind of finding the unknowns and getting to know them, because they're the star. They're going to be the stars, or they're the ones that help those people who actually are on the podium get there. The teams will say they don't have enough money to hire a marketing person. Well, these days you could have a writer sit there creating your marketing. You could do your social media. And I think we need to do a better job. The teams need to do a better job of marketing their assets, and the assets are the riders. And there are a couple teams out there that do it well, and there are a couple teams that don't do it at all. And I think as part of a rider contract, you have to negotiate that they will take it upon themselves to market themselves, however that team sees fit and however they want it done, but it has to be done. Everybody should have the social media outlets, and they should use it on a frequent basis, because that's how we get to know personalities.
So one of the things also I wanted to ask you about was that you have a bike shop, or you co-founded a bike shop.
That bike shop for me was the reason why I think everything came full circle. We had an opportunity. We knew that we wanted to focus on women. Anytime a woman walked through the door, we were going to give her attention. We were going to treat her differently than most bike shops had treated women. And that was a huge, huge piece for me. It was so important, because I thought back to how I was treated at a bike shop, and how the reason why I all of a sudden was given opportunities to become a cyclist was because I was treated really well at one bike shop in Nashville, Cumberland Transit. And I said, you know, we're going to focus on women. And sure enough, at some point in time, I can't even remember where it was, we had so many women coming in and doing our training classes. And it was such a great feeling. And I love being on the ground floor, coaching and helping people, teaching people how to clip in. Like that was just the essence of it for us. And, you know, it's still thriving. Uptown Cycles is still around, and they do a lot of different things there. But for me, it was like putting our passion into real life and helping other people get on bikes. And it was just, I think I look back at it, and it was some of like my happiest times. Really, if you decide not to focus or not to give women what they need, you're going to miss half of your market. I would say the fastest growing market these days in women and in cycling is like masters women. I have, and they're the ones who have the resources. They have time. They are dedicated. They've pretty much had careers, or they've done something. They've been moms, and now they have the time on their hands. And I'm seeing more women, more master's women, come to me for coaching right now than I ever had before. And I think that's super exciting. In fact, USA Cycling is creating more master's categories for women than they've never done that before, because they're seeing this number grow.
Cool.
They spend a lot of money. It's fantastic. I think they're finally finding camaraderie in the sport. And I wanted to add, you know, it's interesting because from the bike shop, it's been what I did learn is that women want to be involved in camps and clinics. They want to do things. And it's been awesome because now that I've retired from racing, I've been lucky enough to partner with a woman down in Santa Barbara. We've created our coaching business together, Revolution Coaching. And now we have the time and the energy to put into creating camps. And we've done a women's camp. We did two last fall out of Solvang, California. We did WOW, so it's Women on Wheels cycling camps. And we had, you know, 20 women come to our camp. It was a 5-day camp of riding, coaching, and to me, those are the most gratifying things that we can offer. We're giving experience, we're giving knowledge, we're giving empowerment. It's a really beautiful thing. And so I find myself now spending a little bit more time focusing on creating an experience for women on their bikes. And it's just been great. I love it. It's like the perfect job.
I do want to talk a little bit about what you've been doing with the Paralympic team.
Yeah. Last year when I was directing, I had the opportunity to bring on at Redlands last year, Sam Bosco, who is a Paralympian. She went to Rio this past year and won a couple medals. She was from the area, LA, and I brought her on and we got to talking about the paracycling team. And so I told her, I was like, you know, if an opportunity ever came up for a pilot, so when you have a tandem, there's a pilot and there's a stoker, and the pilot rides in the front, the stoker's in the back. If an opportunity ever came up for a pilot position on a tandem with someone who is blind or any other disability, it's usually blind, I would love the opportunity to kind of just see if it's something that I would want to do. And crazy enough, an opportunity came up last June with a woman named Shawn Cheshire. She is completely blind, and she had been racing for about 3 years on the tandem with different pilots. And so we got together in June in Santa Barbara, took a little ride together, and I was like, wow, that is the most intense cycling experience I've had in so long. You are not only riding your bike, but you are constantly communicating everything that's going on.
Verbally? You're talking to her?
Verbally. You have to be saying left turn, right turn, downhill. We went to our first paracycling camp. So this was our first real opportunity to get to ride together in a team setting. There were athletes there from all over the country who were on the paracycling team. There's a director, a team coach. It was really fascinating. So Sean and I got to spend 5 days riding together on the tandem, learning each other, communicating. It's one of the most difficult things that I've ever done on a bike. It becomes exhausting, but it just becomes kind of second nature. And, you know, Sean and I are still working through like personalities and you basically want to become one on the bike. When Sean and I decided to do this partnership, the first thing we decided was that we were going to bring on a sports psychologist, because we felt communication was the one thing that we could absolutely work on from the gun. And so she has helped us navigate kind of a partnership. When this opportunity came to me, I thought, you know what? I have nothing to lose. I think all I can do is gain from this opportunity, be on a team again, you know, learn to communicate on a different level, a higher level, and really just, you know, be part of something bigger than myself. And so it was super appealing to do this. And after our week at camp together, I had this week, so I'm home this week, to time to kind of decompress and think about it. And, you know, I went through a lot of highs and lows last week. It's exhilarating, but yet you're like, what am I doing? It's like, you know, this is not what you know. It's learning something completely different. It's starting over. And so I was excited about that because I like challenges and I like to push myself. And so I'm actually leaving on Sunday to go down to the LA track and we're going to be working together on the tandem on the track, which I've never done before. I've only ridden the track a couple times. So this is, it's kind of scary, but it's also kind of fun. And, you know, we have plans to race several World Cups together on the tandem on the road. We'll be traveling to Europe. There's a race in Italy, the Netherlands, Belgium, and then the World Championships are in South Africa in September.
Wow,
so
that sounds
awesome. Yeah, I've kind of jumped in with both feet and let's just do it and see how it goes. So, you know, I'm excited. And this week at track camp will be an adventure, I'm sure, considering I haven't ridden a track bike in ages. So I think, you know, we just kind of take it as it comes. And, you know, I'm excited about the opportunity.
And she trains full time?
Yes. So she became blind about 4 years ago. She served in the armed forces and then took a job as an EMT and had an accident in an ambulance, hit her head, went partially blind, and then within a year became totally blind. So she has, in the last 4 years, come from being, you know, working an EMT to like being an athlete. She's, you know, she trains every day. She's disciplined, just like any other athlete would be. And, you know, we get the opportunity to ride together a couple times a month on the tandem. So whether you're with the tandem partner or whether you're on your own, you still do all the training.
Right. And now how are you going to change your training for this, if at all? And how are you going to train for the track?
So that's great. That's a great question. I have someone who is helping me. I mean, as a coach, I believe in using a coach. And so I have a coach that's giving me specific workouts now. They are different from what I was doing as just a road cyclist. You know, when I get off the phone with you, I'm going to go sit on the trainer because it's pouring down rain, which I haven't ridden a trainer in a couple of years. So it's been, that's been a little bit of adjustment. You know, I try to find something fun to watch on TV, but, yeah, so I'll do some high intensity stuff. You know, part of the process for me to get back into the racing scene was just coming to the terms that I'm going to have to train again. And I think when you call yourself an athlete, you feel like you can pretty much jump into anything and go do it, but you don't really know what those repercussions are. And so I'm kind of figuring out that, you know, taking a year off from racing is very different and difficult to get back into the training regimen than I thought it was going to be. So I'm having to work through a little bit of that, not to mention that I'm 39 now and, you know, I'm not a spring chicken anymore, I would say, but I definitely I've kept my fitness level up. It's just different. So I'm having to learn some things that, you know, I wasn't necessarily keen to 5 years ago.
And what events are you going to be doing on the track?
We are doing the Pursuit and we're doing the Kilo.
And how about on the road? What are the races like on the road?
So the World Cup races, they are similar to a road race course. They can be hilly. Typically the ones that I've heard about in Europe, in Italy are very hilly, little cobbles. So cobblestone roads. You know, it's a mass start race. So we will start with other tandems, you know, right in the start gate, just like you would a road race. And so, you know, tactics have to be implemented. You know, it's a lot about energy conservation and just like you would in a road race, except, you know, you have people on tandem. So I have not seen the courses. I've only seen profiles and they're definitely have some elevation gain. So I find that's like the hardest part is when you get on a tandem and you climb, you feel like there's a lot more force on your legs. Like when you climb, it's hard. And yes, you do feel loaded, but like on a tandem, you feel it more in your, kind of in your knee area, in your lower quad. And it's been interesting. So, you know, I think the best way that we can approach these races is just spend more time together and go out and train on some harder terrain.
Well, I want to start wrapping things up, but is there anything else you'd like to mention or talk about?
You know, I just want to say thank you, and I'm very appreciative of having this opportunity. And I think, you know, more just the fact that you are interviewing women in sports, I think is fantastic. you know, I want to encourage more people to, you know, be interviewed and not be afraid to show who you are to the media and to the world. I think it's, you know, we are only as strong as who we are. And I think we can each do a lot of good if we decide to put our efforts and energy into it. So, you know, I feel very grateful that you're taking the time and opportunity to reach out to people in different areas and get their perspectives and, you know, see what they're doing. So we can all work together instead of working in separate pieces. You know, it's like, how can we pull our energy together and efforts to become, to make things better for our sport and different sports in that matter.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. You know, we have a velodrome here that has gotten a lot of support.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was built by a bunch of friends, and they decided, hey, I really want a velodrome, and so they built it.
That's awesome. Well, let's come to Cleveland.
Because Hear Her Sports is a new podcast, please take a few minutes on iTunes to rate it, or even write a review so more people can find out about it. There's a yellow iTunes link on the upper right side of hearhersports.com. The Hear Her notebooks are now available and have started to ship, ordered directly from the website. Support the female athletes you know by attending a women's sporting event or watching one on TV. Follow us on Instagram for some images of what's going on.
Have you ever wanted to know how to win a Formula One Grand Prix? I mean, really know. Know about the driver tactics from the cockpit, the strategy calls from the pit wall, and even the mind games in the paddock. There's a lot more that goes into winning a Grand Prix than just 90 minutes of racing. So every week on the F1 Strategy Report, we're taking a deep dive into the decisions that shape every result. Hey there, my name is Michael Laminato, and every week I'm joined by an expert guest from the paddock to talk through the big calls that won the race and the missteps that resulted in bitter defeat. Before every race, we'll look back at the previous year's result and consult the current form guide, and we'll be in your feed after every Grand Prix dissecting the outcome and what it means for the championship. So for your regular hit of Formula One analysis, subscribe to the F1 Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcasts Network. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you after the checkered flag.